Welcome to Hunger for Wholeness. I'm your host, Robert Nicastro. In this episode, we revisit Elia's conversation with process theologian Bruce Epperly. Last week, Bruce and Elia gave an introduction to process thought and how it can help us heal divisions. Today, they ask, how do we see the divine in the other, especially in those relationships we find contentious? And later, Bruce and Elia explore the importance of personal sacrifice for an equitable and worthwhile future.
God as the ongoing activity of our lives, you know, the ongoing creative activity.
Yes.
That's what it's about. You know, it's we can find, we may not resolve our past, our difficulties, all that has divided us, but God is that creative, the lure.
Yep.
You know, holding out to us, here's a new possibility.
Yes.
But you have to choose it.
Yes. To see with the eyes of Christ and to see the divine in the other, I think, is essential, even as you're contesting. Again, Howard Thurman comes from a Jim Crow era, and he knows about what it means to be second class, and he knows, and it was very much influential on Martin Luther King, and he recognizes that you have to try to appeal to the highest good in those you are protesting against. You have to believe that it's possible for them to change and for you to change.
Yes.
I think the Sermon on the Mount is filled with all sorts of words about loving our enemies, and that's not meant to be an abstraction. It's meant to say, somehow or other, I have to live with this person who's so very different than me, and I have to not necessarily excuse bad behavior, and sometimes the best loving thing to do is challenge bad policies and bad behavior and say, is that really worthy of you? But no, you too have to undergo a process of conversion, because there's always a greater self in us that we have not yet realized. I mean, I think one of the gifts of both Whitehead and Teilhard is they have a belief that the person that is us or any person is bigger than they think they are, that there's more to us, because the process of the unfolding of evolution toward the omega point is going straight through our experience.
Yeah.
And there's something about the omega point that's in us.
Yes.
And Whitehead might say it differently, but he would probably say that, you know, the divine ideal of truth and beauty and goodness is embedded in us even when we don't know it. You know, God doesn't give up on anyone, nor should we.
Yeah. No, I love that. You know, actually, as you're talking, I'm thinking of Francis of Assisi's, the famous lines that we often use, let us begin, for until now we have done nothing.
Yes.
You know, this is what Francis said at the end of his life.
Yes.
In other words, there's always the capacity to do more. And then he said, I have done what is mine to do. May Christ teach you yours.
Yes.
You know, in other words, we have an infinite capacity within us for the moreness of life.
Yes.
And I think, you know, Bruce, you said something that just, I think we have to just, you know, sometimes say it explicitly. Where is our will, our heart? What do we really want? What's our real desire?
Yes.
Do we really want world peace? Do we really want a sustainable earth?
Yes.
We say these things sometimes, but is our will, because where our will is, which I take is the place of our deepest energies, you know, our heart's desires.
Yes.
That where that will is, that's where we're going to focus our energies.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that, you know, we really want, for example, racial justice, or we really want, you know, economic justice, or we really want a sustainable earth.
Yes.
It's nice to talk about these things because dialogue is cheap, you know, and these ideas, very nice. They're kind of therapeutic in some ways. Well, who wouldn't want, you know, a clean earth and a just community?
Yes.
But it means changing our lives, you know.
Yes.
And that's really the key, you know.
Yes, that really is. And how do we, Whitehead uses an interesting idea to move from self-interest to world loyalty, or to identify your well-being with a larger well-being, that to identify that, you know, peace is the expansion of consciousness to embrace larger and larger circles of concern. I see that in Bonaventure's comment, and he apparently inherited the comment, but he quotes it as from someone else, but he quotes it as gospel truth, the infinite sphere whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere, that the circumference that's nowhere calls the particular center that I am to become as large as I can be, to become a Mahatma, a good ancestor, as our, while we're still living, as Yorubans would say, or the Ifa people, to become a little Christ, as Luther often said, or to become a bodhisattva while you're still living,
yeah,
to wish all sentient beings well-being,
yeah,
and to make the sacrifices. I mean, I have to admit that I'm a privileged person, and I realize that the world really requires some sort of enforced, and I say enforced because some things shouldn't be optional, enforced sacrificial living, and it's better to choose it than to have it forced on you.
Yes.
It's a little bit like the civil rights laws. We needed to have them so civil rights and human rights and marriage equality is non-negotiable, and it's not a matter of how I feel when I get up in the morning, but we need to institutionalize a certain type of simplicity and sacrificial living that, in a sense, allows folks like me to creatively lower our lifestyle and income,
yep,
and so that others might be raised up. I mean, the old live simply so others might simply live. And I need to be shown that it's a better way.
We definitely have developed this consumer mentality and a consumer habit of a lifestyle because it's comfortable, it's accessible, it's immediate. But I also think that this kind of consumer mentality goes hand in hand with the loneliness in our culture.
Oh, yes.
When you go back to simplicity, I know even in my own family, my parents lived through the Depression, and my mother told lots of stories how sometimes she had to go to the pawn shop to sell some things to buy the,
yep,
you know, Thanksgiving,
yep,
turkey.
My family too, yeah.
Yeah, it was hard, but they had one another, you know, and I think that's the one thing. I'm watching the series Heartland, actually, on Netflix.
Yes.
I really like it because the beauty of family, you don't always agree, you know, there's all sorts of, but there's such a bond there in that family. And, you know, there is something about simple living, living close to the earth, you know, to realize the preciousness of the natural resources of water and soil.
Yes.
And, you know, access to these things, sometimes you have to drive for miles to get to the store.
Yes.
You know, the type of simple living where you would make a lot of food. You know, you didn't buy processed food.
Yes.
You didn't buy fast food. You didn't have McDonald's or Wendy's.
Yeah.
You know, you went to the meat store and you might buy a hamburger maybe, you know, once a month or something. You might,
yep,
buy that hamburger meat. And so we're kind of out of control, basically.
Yes.
And we have become this kind of vortex of consumerism where we can't slow down.
Yes.
Because to slow down now would become anti-natural for us. We wouldn't know.
Yes.
But it's going to happen to us because the unhealthy lifestyle we've developed is actually depleting our resources in many ways. We have this kind of overpopulation, limited resources. Just for an example, my students took the ecological footprint last week, and it would take about 6.5 Earths for every student to live their lifestyle.
Yep.
It's unsustainable. So I completely agree with your emphasis on sacrifice and simplicity, but how to get back there? And I'm afraid it might be enforced on us by, you know.
That's the apocalyptic and the dystopian vision, is that, you know, eventually the emperor will have no clothes, and eventually we can't technologically solve everything. I mean, I think, again, the mystics remind us that the goodness of life is something that comes from the simple fact of appreciation, the simple fact of relationship, the simple fact of love and sacrifice for a greater good than ourselves, that, you know, we can, as Jesus says, gain the world and lose our souls, and have to constantly nourish our souls with things that probably don't satisfy.
Right.
You know, why do you eat things that don't satisfy or have things that don't satisfy, the prophet says. But there is a soul food that does satisfy.
Yes.
There is a soul food that satisfies. And it's, I think, comes from having a larger self that is bigger than this moment. I mean, I think the gift that both the process theology in its many forms gives us is it embeds us in the now, but within the now is the great vision of what could be.
Yes.
You know, within the now is the, to use Teilhard's language, the omega point. Within the now is the vision of truth, goodness, and beauty, as Whitehead would say. And if we listen to that, it takes us beyond individualism. What does Bill McKibben, the environmentalist, say, that the best thing an individual can do is to quit being an individual?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I'm teaching a lay course for my church where I belong on the Trinity of all things. I belong to the United Church of Christ, so we're not a highly doctrinal church, and there oftentimes we're called the Unitarians Considering Christ as a good term for the United Church of Christ, UCC. But in looking at the Trinity is really about sacrificial relational love that, as Bonaventure would say, flows out into the world. It doesn't require the Father, in quotes, the Creator doesn't require the death of Jesus, but Jesus sacrifices the individual self for the greater self.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think what you're pointing to is something we don't talk sufficiently about, and that is the moreness that's at the heart of each of our lives.
Yes.
Like what we do is we say, this is it, and it's not good, you know?
Yeah.
I think this also drives consumerism, that we need more something, so we'll get more stuff. But the fact is, our needs are never really met because, you know, as Augustine so beautifully wrote, our hearts are restless until they rest.
Yes.
In God, you know, that God is that wholeness of life, that fullness of life, that, you know, unquenchable fountain of life. Again, as you say, to use Bonaventure's language here. And so sometimes I think if we could slow down, you know, and just recognize, what do we really want? You know, what it fundamentally, at the heart of our lives, what do we want?
Yes.
It's a very simple question, you know, and what do we really need to get there?
Individual sacrifice may build a better future. But what can we do on the community level? Can religious institutions help? Next, drawing on his wealth of pastoral experience, Bruce shares what he thinks our modern communities, churches, political or otherwise, can learn from our spiritual traditions. And later, Ilya and Bruce consider the Christian image of the Trinity, what it teaches us about sacrifice and diversity.
Have so overcomplicated and so overcomplexified the world, we're lost in it.
Yes.
You know, we're in this very fast-moving, very complex world, and we don't know where we're going.
You know, I think back to the notion that one of the tasks of institutions, especially religious institutions, is to help people have a larger vista, is to help people look beyond this moment and this particular individual self. I mean, we do this, but we don't make it a practice. I'm at the grateful beck and call of my family and grandchildren. One of them's upstairs with my wife right now. And when I raced home I raced home with him, and he was going to go work on some projects. The other part of the family is doing things. There's a sense that their well-being and mine, there's no, that's seamless. It's a healthy seamlessness. It's not, you know, an unhealthy, it's a healthy one. And the same for congregations. The other thing I think churches and religious institutions need to remind people of the spiritual arts, that beginning in childhood, I mean, I work with my own grandchildren on simple meditative exercises, just simply learning to breathe slowly, to stop or to start the day, and they're 13 and 11, start the day with a moment of quiet and set an intention for the day. And to begin, I mean, they're regular kids. I mean, they're regular kids, but you can take that deeper place of quiet that calms us down and that helps us overcome the polarization.
Yes.
Maybe we would do better in the political arena. I don't know if it could ever happen if we simply invited people at a rally, a political rally, just to be still for a moment.
Wow.
And then ask the question, what do we really want for America and the planet, and how do we want to get there? And then, you know, what do we really want? Do we really want retribution for our opponents? Do we really want to be the sort of people who think that children of God are vermin or poisonous? Do we really want to be people who deplete the environment? Is this what we want to give our grandchildren? And asking those questions, it's basically spirit, you know, we need probably built in some form of spiritual formation where we keep asking that question that you do, Ilya. What do you want? What's the deepest desire of your heart?
Yeah.
And of course, both Teilhard and Whitehead, and I keep coming back to them because I think in many ways they believe there's a Godwardness that's confronting us moment by moment. I've come up with this little term, you know, a lot of Christians are concerned about the second coming. And of course, the second coming of Jesus, all the prognostications have one thing in common. They're always wrong. But there's enough prognostications of the second coming that I've coined the phrase a millisecond coming.
Oh, that's good.
That I don't want a second coming. I want a millisecond coming. I want to know the divine's coming to me each second of the day, and that every so often I'll notice it. God was in this place and I noticed it today. God was in this person. So to be a bit of humor, there's a particular politician that's oftentimes described as the orange Jesus. I want to see the Jesus and not the orange, if you understand. In that politician, I want to see that person, as they say in some African language, I see you, I see you. I want to see them. I want my eyes to open Aldous Huxley say, if the doors of perception were opened, we'd see things for what they truly are, infinite.
Yeah.
Or as Dorothy Day says, is, you know, to talk to people as if they're angels.
The other day, I was reading the New Testament scholar Larry Hurtado.
Oh, yes.
Who wrote a chapter, in fact, his book on devotion in the early church, on the mutation of Jesus. Jesus as a mutation. And I thought it was so insightful. And he was talking how, you know, Jesus, who was, you know, born Jewish, moved from that Jewish Judaic monotheism into a new consciousness.
Yes.
This consciousness of a power, that name of Abba or God or Father.
Yes.
At the heart of his life. And in his own life, this mutation from monotheism to bitheism, in a sense.
Yes.
You know, there's something operating here that's more God, you know, than just God up there. There's a God here in the now, in my life, in this world, this
yes.
in-breaking God. And that's the seed, he says, of Trinity, you know,
yes.
as we move from monotheism to Trinitarian type of theism. And yes. I think we have yet to really grasp, because you mentioned Trinity before, we have yet to really grow into what Trinity means for us, you know,
yes.
in this new reality of God. Christianity is about a new reality of God.
Yes.
And we're still like in some old reality. We're still something that You know, we were supposed to have moved beyond, but we got stopped for various reasons.
Well, yeah, I think so. And, you know, as I look at the Trinity, and it is not binary. That's the first thing we can say about a Trinity is it is binary.
Right.
And that it is a built-in diversity in God that parents forth the diverse world such that diversity is never a fall from grace, but an expression of the Trinity.
Yes, exactly. Diversity is what God is about. That's the whole point. Like, the beauty of God is precisely in the diversity of divine love incarnate. I'm so grateful for this conversation as well. It's been very, very rich with your amazing knowledge and insights. You continue to write and publish books. What's your latest book for our hearers?
Well, you know, there's a couple of them that I'm just really proud of. I'm proud of all of them. As you as an author of great many books, you know, they're all our children. But I really am proud of the book, Jesus, Mystic Healer and Prophet. I don't know if I ever sent that to you, but it really, to me, captures what the church ought to be doing, healing, promoting spiritual experience, and prophetic work. I just am finishing the last drafts, and I did this with fear and trembling, because, of course, you know, I thought a book on Bonaventure that Franciscan Media asked me to write for them. And I said to myself, dare I write a book that Filio has written in the same area? Dare I do it? And I pored over your book. I pored over simply Bonaventure, because for me, that's the gold standard.
Wow, thank you.
I'm serious. I'm not being gratuitous. And then I thought to myself, after finishing this book, and it's going to be in pre-publication another week or so from Franciscan Media, my book is also the gold standard. You came at Bonaventure with your gifts, and I came at it with my gifts. And in many ways, mine is very pastoral and in the approach to Bonaventure. Yours is more academic and theoretical. They both capture Bonaventure. And so
wonderful.
It's on the way. And I think that Bonaventure's fountain flows through me, and it flows through you, because you not only write about the not yet God, it's the not yet book that's on the way for you, Ilya. We're all looking for that not yet book, both you and I, and because there's so many ideas and so many ways that we want to shape the world for good.
That is so true, Bruce, so true. I just love your Franciscan spirit, and I'm thrilled that you wrote this book on Bonaventure. So I really look forward to its publication.
You will see it.
Yeah, wonderful.
Thanks to our partners at the Fetzer Institute, and a special thanks to Bruce Epperly for joining us. Learn more about Bruce's books and other work by visiting drbruceepperly.com. If you'd like to stay updated on our new episodes, follow Hunger for Wholeness on social media, or visit christogenesis.org to dig deeper into the work of Ilya Delio and the Center for Christogenesis. As always, I'm Robert Nicastro. Thanks for listening.